Chapter 10. The Arms Race of the Human Race. When given the opportunity to gain some type of advantage over others, even at a considerable risk, some subset of us takes it. We've evolved this way. From the moment life emerged, our ancestors entered a never-ending arms race with each other and other species for advantage and survival. We fought our way to the top of the food chain and avoided being ground up as burgers for some other species because we've, so far, won that competition. In our nomadic hunter-gatherer days, human groups in many places competed relentlessly with each other, often stealing each other's resources. When the advent of agriculture, writing, and other technologies made it possible to organize ourselves into larger communities, we wasted no time translating each little technological advantage into individual and collective opportunities to rob, subjugate, and oppress each other. The Mongols leveraged the stirrup to give their horsemen additional oomph to conquer much of the known world. The European colonial powers used their advanced ships and weapons to dominate and exploit big portions of the globe. The initial technological advantage the Germans and Japanese enjoyed in the Second World War was overcome by the even more powerful competitive advantage of the American, British, and European emigre scientists who developed the radar, advanced cryptography, radio navigation, and nuclear weapons that helped win the war. In these cases, and so many more, competition fueled technological development even when the technologies being developed had both great upsides and dangerous potential downsides. And although utopians for many centuries have imagined a world where we all fully embrace our Buddha nature and escape the cycle of incessant competition with each other, that day has not yet arrived. Even though levels of large-scale conflict have been decreasing around the world for decades, it would be dangerous folly to believe that the genetics revolution, with its great upsides and dangerous potential downsides, will play out in the harmonious, non-competitive world we can imagine, rather than the highly competitive one we have known. Instead, the magnitude and consequences of this competition will grow as the technology advances. In the early years of this expanding revolution, particularly when our understanding of what genes do, how the body works, and what manipulations are most beneficial is in its infancy, an artificial distinction between therapy and enhancement will be maintained. We will be able to maintain the fiction that the genetics revolution is primarily and ultimately about enhancing healthcare and treating disease. In the early years, doctors working to prevent or treating a certain disorder or disease may want to overshoot the mark of normal by giving an embryo, or even a grown person, extra advantages. Because what is considered a therapy to one person might be considered an enhancement to another, our concept of what is normal will prove a moving target. As therapeutic applications of powerful genetic technologies become the norm, the distinction between what constitutes a therapy and a genetic enhancement will increasingly blur. We will ask, to give a few examples, whether there's really a fundamental difference between genetically enhancing someone's poor eyesight to be normal versus their normal eyesight to be great, or if there's really a difference between genetically enhancing a patient's cellular ability to fight a cancer or AIDS that's already developed, or their ability to never get cancer or AIDS in the first place. Parents, in other words, will increasingly wonder if there's really a difference between giving their children advantages of nurture versus providing the same advantages through nature. The more enhancements like these become available and seen as beneficial, the more competition within and between communities will push our highly competitive fellow humans to want them. The sporting world provides a particularly illuminating window into how competitive pressures can and likely will spur a genetic arms race. There is little doubt that genetics play a central role in achievement in sports at the highest levels. Where the rules are clearly defined, The capabilities needed for success are relatively specific, and the distribution of non-genetic assets are evenly distributed. That's why there are so few 5-foot players in the National Basketball Association. As David Epstein describes in his 2013 book, The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance, Finland's Eero Mäntyranta was one of the most dominant Nordic skiers in history, winning 7 Olympic medals, including 3 golds, and 2 world championships between 1960 and 1972. A consummate champion, Mäntyranta had a tremendous work ethic and indomitable spirit. When he and his family were genetically sequenced in the early 1990s, however, it turned out that Mäntyranta and 29 of his relatives also had a very rare single mutation of the EPOR gene. This mutation made them far better able than others to produce hemoglobin, the red blood cells that transport oxygen from the lungs to body tissues, which gave them a far greater than normal endurance capacity. Not every relative with this mutation was an Olympic champion, few were, but having this mutation certainly increased their odds. Athletic success is a complex phenomenon that cannot, of course, be attributed to any one gene, even one like Mäntyranta's. Lots of other factors like nutrition, parenting, drive, coaching, access, and luck play important roles. But that doesn't mean single genes can't be critically important. Lots of people have a mutation of their ACTN3 gene, one of the unknown larger number of genes influencing the speed at which muscles contract. Although many athletic performance-related genes have been studied, ACTN3 is so far the only one that correlates with performance across multiple power sports. When researchers knocked out this single gene in mice, the mice lost significant levels of muscle power. Having the right ACTN3 variant won't make you a great sprinter, but multiple studies have shown that if you have 2 disrupted copies of ACTN3, your chances of making it to the Olympic finals in any sprinting race are virtually nil. If you have a mutation of the MSTN gene impeding the production of myostatin, on the other hand, a protein that halts the production of muscles, your muscles keep growing far beyond most everyone else's. Liam Hoekstra, a child with this myostatin mutation dubbed the world's strongest toddler, could do challenging gymnastics tricks at 5 months old and pull-ups at 8 months. Genetics are also proving highly influential in elite marathon running. The spectacular success of Kenya's Kalenjin tribe, and even more of its Nandi sub-tribe, is a case in point. Most everybody knows that Kenyan runners have dominated distance running for decades. Between 1986 and 2003, the percentage of Kenyan male runners included in the top 20 fastest times ever in races 800 meters and longer increased from 13.3% to an astonishing 55.8%. Over the past 30 years, Kenyan-born men have won nearly half of all Olympic medals in distance running events and almost all of the world cross-country championships. But the Kenyan running success story is more precisely a Kalenjin success story. About 3/4 of Kenyan running champions are Kalenjins, a tiny group making up only 4.4 million of Kenya's 41 million people. Kalenjin runners won 84% of Kenya's 64 Olympic and 8 World Championship medals between 1964 and 2012, and were responsible for 20 of Kenya's fastest 25 marathon times. The majority of these Kalenjin runners come from the even smaller Nandi sub-tribe, a group of about 1 million people in total. While this running success reflects lots of hard work, a national running culture, and other environmental factors, the genetic foundation of Kalenjin dominance is hard to miss. Kalenjin runners have, on average, longer legs, shorter torsos, thinner limbs, and less mass in relation to height than most everyone else, to which anyone who's ever watched a competitive marathon over past decades can attest. Swedish researchers testing Kellingen children in 1990 found remarkably that over 500 Kellingen schoolboys could run 2,000 meters faster than Sweden's fastest champion. After researchers from a Danish sports science institute trained a large group of Kellingen boys for 3 months in 2000, many allegedly ran faster than a leading Danish runner. Although no single marathon gene has been or will likely be discovered, researchers have identified the important influence over 200 genes can have in athletic performance. A 2008 study that assessed the possibility of a given runner having each of the 23 best understood of these athleticism-related genes concluded it would be extremely small, about 0.0005% of all people. If that's true, that would mean that China, with its 2018 population of 1.34 billion people, would have 6,700 people with these genetic attributes spread across all age groups. The United States, with its population of 324 million, would have 1,620. Imagine a country, let's say China, decided to use the data it is already collecting when sequencing its newborns to determine which among them would have the greatest chance to be star athletes of one type or another. The genetic potential could be flagged to parents and sports associations, who might be encouraged to give these children special opportunities to participate in sports where they might have some type of advantage. Those children demonstrating the greatest aptitude and passion for a given sport could be invited to join special leagues where the best players could be encouraged or required to attend special sports schools and receive rigorous additional training. The best among these genetic stars would be identified to represent the country internationally. A bit of this is already happening. When attending women's volleyball semifinals in the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing, I noticed a strange contrast between the American and Chinese athletes. The Americans were a hodgepodge of various shapes and sizes. In the American model, young athletes are often self-starters or the children of obsessive parents. Some of the American players, I am sure, had levels of heart, determination, team spirit, or charisma that had brought them to the Olympics. The Chinese, on the other hand, were far more uniform in appearance. Like the Soviets decades before, the Chinese often identify potential athletes based on physical attributes at an early age, and then train and cull them through special sports schools around the country. Critics may not like this sports school model, particularly when families have been coerced to give up their children to these schools, but few would call identifying young athletes for athletic potential cheating. The Beijing volleyball competition was not just between two teams, but also between two different forms of societal organization. It may be that the American individualist system proves better able to create dominant athletes. The Chinese and Russian statist systems may do better, or some hybrid of the two will carry the day. Over time, however, this will not remain a theoretical point. Athletic success will be measured in the ongoing arms race of Olympic medals. Bringing advanced genetic capabilities to the sports arms race won't just create new opportunities for cheaters, but also challenge our conceptions of what constitutes fair play. People have long complained that the state-sponsored doping of athletes in the Soviet bloc countries, Russia, China, and elsewhere, and athletes like cyclist Lance Armstrong, who artificially stimulated his body's production of red blood cells to boost hemoglobin levels, were cheating. They were, according to the rules of their sports. At some point in the near future, athletes will be able to have their cells extracted and gene-edited, then reintroduced to their bodies to increase endurance and speed up muscular repair. This type of gene doping will clearly be cheating, based on the current rules in most sports. But now that we can look under the genetic hood, is it fair for a person without an extra hemoglobin-producing mutation to compete against someone who has it? What do we think about people like Mataranta, whose bodies are, on their own, doing what the cheaters are seeking to mimic? Are athletes like Lance Armstrong committing a violation by artificially boosting their hemoglobin production, or just leveling the playing field by Mataranta-ing themselves? The more genetic predispositions for relative success in certain sports can be identified, the less fair it will be for athletes without them. But because all humans are genetically different from each other, penalizing an athlete for having an advantageous genetic difference would be like penalizing a physicist for having a genetic predisposition for strong math skills, or a musician for having perfect pitch. Once we understand these genetic differences that give some athletes an inborn genetic advantage over others, one response might be to categorize athletes by their genetic differences, where people like Eero Mäntyranta could compete against each other, and people like Lance Armstrong could do the same. Kellingen runners could likewise race against each other, and we'd have a different competition for everyone else. This would be entirely absurd for many reasons, not least because physical diversity is the essence of competitive sports, and because it would be impossible to determine which particular set of genetic attributes created the greatest chance of success. Alternatively, we might divide athletes into categories of genetically altered and genetically unadulterated. Whatever we do, will people be more drawn to the non-genetically selected and unenhanced athletes with their slower times and decreased performance, or to the enhanced super-athletes who continually break records and expand our concepts of what humans can achieve? Olympic champions, professional athletes, and other sports stars stand to reap enormous rewards and earn huge amounts of money from their athletic success, and they are often willing to take extraordinary measures to gain advantage. Some of these measures are dangerous, but compromising the health of athletes is the essence of some sports. Football, boxing, and free climbing are but a few examples. Athletes can always opt out, but competitive sports, like evolution, create arms race environments where each embrace of a particular advantage sets a new bar for other competitors to follow. Given the massive financial and other rewards that come from being a top professional athlete, we can almost understand how people with these aspirations are willing to risk even their future well-being in pursuit of their dreams. But it's not just aspiring professional athletes willing to embrace new technologies that create these kinds of potential risks. Even average parents are doing the same to help their children realize their athletic hopes. In the sports-obsessed United States, parents place their children in competitive sports programs when they are as young as 4. Some 12-year-olds have insanely competitive schedules almost equivalent to professional athletes. To serve this market of zealous parents, a large industry of direct-to-consumer genetic tests for athletic performance has emerged in recent years. Companies like Atlas Biomed, DNA Fit, Genotech, Gonidio, and WeGene offer parents and others information on whether a tested person's genetic tests indicate single gene mutations believed to confer one athletic benefit or another. Although these predictions are today generally not that informative, they will become far more operative as our understanding of the genome grows, creating new possibilities for parents. As more genes associated with athletic performance are identified, parents will have the option to consider genetic predictors of athletic potential in one or another area when selecting which of their embryos to implant during IVF. Under current U.S. law, nothing would prevent clinics from offering, or parents from making, this type of determination. Let's say parents selected an embryo to implant based on a predicted likelihood of the future child being a competitive sprinter or producing more than average hemoglobin, or simply tested a newborn for these genetic indications using a product from a direct-to-consumer provider. Would U.S. athletic associations and elite athletic training programs at least want to consider this information as one data point when deciding which young athletes to support, especially if competitor countries like China were already doing so? Jiaxu Jin, a private Chinese company based in Beijing, reported on its website that it was already working with the Chinese government to screen children for sports-related genes. The national sports teams and coaches have contacted Jiaxu Jin, the site noted, to screen for students with the highest training potential through the company's genetic decoding technology. In 2014, Uzbekistan became the first nation to announce it was integrating genetic testing into its national sports program. In conjunction with its National Olympic Committee and several sports federations, Uzbekistan's Academy of Sciences said it would test children for 50 genes believed to impact athletic potential to help identify possible future stars. In August 2018, China's Ministry of Science and Technology announced that Chinese athletes aspiring to compete in the 2022 Winter Olympics would be required to have their genomes sequenced and profiled for speed, endurance, and explosive force as one factor in an official selection process guided by genetic markers. This type of testing today has a low probability of success because we still know relatively little about what genes do, and because athletic success is such a complex mix of biological and environmental factors. But given that the difference between a national hero world champion sprinter and an also-ran is just a few fractions of a second, other countries and sports organizations will follow Uzbekistan's and China's model if there is even a hint of efficacy. As advanced genetic testing becomes adopted by more countries to identify potential future Olympic stars, other countries will have a choice. If the leaders of sports associations believe genetic testing will not be able to drive success, that it won't matter, or that even if it works, this type of testing violates the spirit of sportsmanship, they can choose to not genetically evaluate young athletes. If they believe genetic testing could have a significant impact on national athletic competition, they might ramp up efforts to do just that. Once the hurdle of widespread genetic testing of athletes is cleared, the barriers to embryo selection and ultimately limited genetic manipulation to enhance athleticism will likely fall in some places for the exact same competitive reasons. People and leaders in the places where this Rubicon is not crossed will then similarly need to figure out how to respond. If they opt out, their national athletes may no longer be competitive in some sports. Athletic competition is only one example of this human and technological arms race where advanced genetics will almost certainly be deployed, albeit in a relatively benign context. Who really cares in the grand scheme of things if the United States never wins another Olympic medal? But we all care a great deal that our children get good jobs and find career success, our national economies are strong, and our countries are able to defend themselves. The genetics of sports analogy isn't just about sports. It's also about life. A truly miracle country, South Korea was in ruins following the devastation of the 1950-1953 Korean War, with seemingly lesser prospects than the poorest African states. Through smart government policies, incredible hard work, and a relentless national devotion to education, however, the country grew from an annual per capita GDP of $64 in 1953 to $27,000 today, and from $41 million in total GDP to $1.4 trillion today, a phenomenal 31,000-fold increase. Korean students today consistently rank among the highest in global comparative student assessments, and the country is among the most educated in the world. Because competition is fierce to ace the National University Entrance Exam, Sonong, to get into the elite universities seen as stepping stones to success, preparation starts young. In addition to the excellent schooling the government provides, 75% of Korean primary school children are enrolled by their parents in one of the 100,000 or so cram schools around the country. Based significantly on this pressure, youth anxiety and suicide rates in South Korea are among the highest in the world. In response, the Korean government in 2006 imposed a 10 p.m. curfew on cram schools because so many children were becoming chronically exhausted from working into the wee hours of morning at these schools. Despite government efforts to reduce the pressure on South Korea's children, the Korean education arms race continues. The race for competitive advantage in South Korea extends far beyond education. Physical beauty is treasured the world over, but Korea takes this to a whole new level. Even though the dangers of plastic surgery are well documented, South Korea has the highest per capita rate of plastic surgery in the world. A BBC poll estimated that around half of all South Korean women in their 20s have had some type of plastic surgery. Korean parents often pay for these plastic surgeries as high school graduation gifts to give their children an additional means of getting ahead. When you're 19, all the girls get plastic surgery, so if you don't do it after a few years, your friends will all look better, but you will look like your unimproved you, a Korean college student told The New Yorker magazine. South Korean parents may be at one end of the spectrum in their willingness to even put their children's health at risk to gain competitive advantages, but they are not alone. Getting kids into top middle and high schools in China often requires parents to use family connections, pay expensive school fees, and bribe teachers and school officials. The Washington Post reported in 2013 that admission to a decent Beijing middle school often requires payments and bribes of upwards of $16,000, according to many parents. Six-figure sums are not unheard of. Once they are in, the workload is enormous, and some children are in school 7 days a week. According to a Reuters report, stiff competition for future jobs and ambitious parents mean long hours in the company of school books, not friends. Like the Korean Sunung, preparation for the Chinese college entrance exam, Gaokao, is brutal and stress-inducing. High pressure can induce student stress and depression, even among the younger students. A 2010 survey of 9 to 12-year-olds in eastern China found that over 80% worried a lot about exams, 67% feared punishment by their teachers, and almost 75% feared physical punishment from their parents if they did not excel. A third exhibited regularly the telltale symptoms of extreme stress. American parents may not, on average, be pushing their children as hard as their Korean or Chinese counterparts, but the immense pressure on American high schoolers to do well on their SAT tests to boost their chances for college admission has sparked a multi-billion-dollar test prep industry. A series of American books with titles like The Pressured Child and The Overscheduled Child argue the most aggressive parents are pushing the boundaries between helping and harming their kids. In the competitive race of life, these parents around the world are not wrong that advantages accrued after birth help children succeed. That's why they are also willing to go to such lengths to provide them, including by accessing new genetic tools. Within the mix of the scores of new direct-to-consumer genetic tests being offered around the world, a small but growing number are being marketed to parents specifically for children. U.S. company Baby Genes offers parents information on about 170 genes with potential health implications. After sending in a mouth swab taken from their children, parents in various countries using these tests are told they can gain insights into their children's food tolerances, eating habits, sensitivity to secondhand smoke, susceptibility to addiction and hyperactivity, and whether the child is a morning or night person. In China, dubious health institutes are now opening across the country, claiming to predict the future strengths of children. One growing chain, Martheim Gene, offers parents a genetic test allegedly identifying their children's talents in 20 different activities, including dancing, math, and sports. Some Chinese parents now pay about $1,500 for a genetic test called My Baby Genome that indicates 950 genes associated with disease risks, 200 with drug reactions, and 100 with physical and personality traits. These types of genetic tests are, for now, far more useful for identifying single gene mutation risks than for accurately predicting any general traits, but the competitive pressure on parents to access this still unproven and, for now at least, still unreliable technology is enormous. Recognizing this, some governments are stepping in to protect consumers. Believing the tests were not sufficiently accurate and that the general public could not handle too much access to genetic data, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2013 temporarily banned the consumer genetics company 23andMe from providing predictive health information to customers about their likelihood of getting genetic diseases. In Europe, France and Germany ban direct-to-consumer genetic testing. But this level of caution will not always be entirely in order as the genetic tests become more predictive by providing polygenic scoring to more accurately predict even complex traits and as consumers get better at handling the information. Harvard medical geneticist Robert Green and his team have shown in a series of studies that regular people can handle even complicated genetic information if properly educated. Providing complex genetic data to the general public would require massive public education, standard setting, and health sector reform, but Green's work shows this is doable. This type of accessible testing, however, will only be the beginning of the consumer-driven adoption curve of genetic technologies, including by parents. Would the subset of parents in Korea and elsewhere already willing to send their children to all-night cram schools be willing to select embryos optimized for the type of success to which the parents aspire? If they were already selecting embryos, might they be willing to genetically alter them to eliminate disease risk and, while doing that, make a few genetic tweaks that could enhance their future child's competitiveness in one area or another? If they are already deploying so much energy to give their children advantages accrued after birth, in other words, how big of a step will it really be for parents to want to give their children advantages accrued before birth? The world's greatest engineers, computer programmers, and other technical specialists all benefit from a range of special advantages over their peers. Genetic aptitude may only be one element of this success. As in sports, grit, resilience, emotional intelligence, personality, relationships, group dynamics, and luck also play a big role. But differences in any one of these, including genetic aptitude, could mean the difference between being, and being recognized and rewarded as, the world leader in many particular fields and not. Because the prospect of an even partly genetically determined future is justifiably frightening to many people today, parents will rightly worry that making decisions about their future children's genetic makeup could diminish their children's sense of autonomy, agency, value, and free will. For these and other reasons, most parents will be able to partly or fully opt out of the genetic testing, assisted reproduction, genetic screening, embryo selection, and genetic engineering at every step along the way. But the choices to opt in, opt out, or do something in between will all come at a competitive cost parents, just like the National Olympic Committees, will need to weigh. Those parents who opt in for full genetic optimization might, to give one example, ensure their children don't get certain diseases, live healthier longer, and have greater chances of excelling at a given task. If the opt-in benefits are great enough, we can imagine an accelerating curve of advantages. a generation of enhanced people could gain the advantages necessary to ensure that their children have greater access to the next generation of enhancements, and so on down the line. These people would also likely want to make sure their children only mated with partners with similar genetic alterations, and that each generation was further genetically engineered so that the multi-generational impact of their enhancements would accrue. Alternately, those parents who opt in might also be setting up their children for a lifetime of pain and suffering if the children aren't interested in performing the functions for which they have been engineered to excel. Because genetics won't be the only success factor, the child might also not be particularly good at what he or she has been optimized to do in the first place. There could also be a social backlash against enhanced people, or some other unforeseen danger. Those who opt out, on the other hand, might relegate their children to second-class status if their children can never match their genetically optimized or enhanced peers in some areas. The capacity difference between those opting in and those opting out in this scenario could grow consistently over time, potentially even creating two classes of people, like H.G. Wells predicted in his 1895 novel, The Time Machine. Whatever happens, competition is likely to drive the process forward, and just like sports authorities and parents, states will also have significant competitive incentives to get on the genetic enhancement bandwagon. When it became clear in 1944 that the Allies would win the Second World War, American and Allied planners started imagining a better world that could emerge from the global ashes of destruction. Because they recognized fixed sovereignty and excessive nationalism as the cancers leading to the two world wars, these visionaries built institutions like the United Nations, the World Bank, and NATO to support new ideas of shared sovereignty and communal responsibility. They established concepts like transnational human rights and international law designed to temper the aggressive and all too dangerous competition between states. In many ways, these plans succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. American enlightened self-interest, backed by military might, provided the framework for growing peace and prosperity across much of the globe. In the decades following the war, the world experienced greater levels of economic growth, innovation, and improvements to the general well-being than in any previous period in human history, despite the decades-long Cold War between the United States and Soviet Union. But countries, like people, exist in a highly competitive context resembling biological evolution, where the status quo never lasts forever. Just like biological organisms translate evolved capabilities into competitive advantages, countries translate the combination of the talents of their populations, governance structures, and natural resources into national power that can be deployed to educate more people, build better governments, get more resources, and gain advantages over others. Although political theorist Francis Fukuyama declared that the end of history had arrived when it looked in 1989 as if liberal democracy had beaten out all other forms of government, this theory crashed into the rocks of the natural history of state competition. After the 1991 collapse of the Soviet Union created a brief moment where U.S.-led globalism ascended, a new challenger was already emerging in the wings. China has been a great civilization for over 4,000 years that fell on hard times in recent centuries. Failing to modernize, it was defeated in a series of battles with European adversaries and Japan over the course of the 19th and early 20th centuries, then suffered terrible destruction as Chinese nationalists battled the invading Japanese during World War II. After the Chinese Communist forces defeated the Nationalists in a civil war and took control of the country in 1949, Mao Zedong declared that the Chinese people had stood up after so many years of foreign domination. But standing up under Mao would have brutal consequences for the Chinese people. In the 20 years following the revolution, Mao's policies devastated China and its people and wiped out its already small industrial and technological base. During the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s and 70s, many universities were closed, scientists were exiled to the countryside, and research came to a screeching halt. Assuming power a couple of years after Mao's death in 1976, Deng Xiaoping recognized science and technology as primary productive forces needed to begin laying the foundation for China's growth. Universities were reopened, scientists were rehabilitated. But as China steadily became wealthier, it bristled at the perceived constraints imposed by American economic, political, and military dominance, and agitated for a return to the exalted Middle Kingdom status China had once enjoyed. Achieving this aspiration required continued economic growth. China's leaders felt it also required a massive military buildup to protect China's access to raw materials and project power at home and abroad. More recently, President Xi Jinping articulated his aspiration for China to achieve its rightful place as a global leader in comprehensive national strength and international influence by 2050 by becoming a world leader in the technologies of the future. China set its sights on matching and then surpassing its greatest rival. The United States has been the world's leader in scientific innovation for nearly a century and has reaped tremendous rewards from pioneering the jet, space, computer, information, biotechnology, genetics, and other scientific revolutions. America's technology leadership ensured that many of the world's leading companies in these sectors would be American ones. At the cusp of its breakout moment for a next generation of revolutionary technologies, including genetics, China's national obsession is not to miss the boat again. Beijing's Sputnik moment arrived when DeepMind's AlphaGo algorithm trounced China's human champions in the game of Go. Already obsessed with harnessing their country's economic, military, and political might to challenge U.S. hegemony, China's leaders realized that becoming the world's leader in AI and other related technologies was the key to winning the struggle for the future across all areas of technology and national power. Because advanced AI is so central to uncovering the secrets of the genome, this aspiration had major implications for the future of human genetic engineering. Beijing's ambitious July 2017 Next Generation Artificial Intelligence Development Plan appeared to borrow liberally from the Obama administration's 2016 plan, but took the national security implications of AI leadership a significant step further. AI has become a new focus of international competition, Beijing's document asserted, and China must firmly seize the strategic initiative in the new stage of international competition in AI development to create new competitive advantage, opening up the development of new space and effectively protecting national security. The document set several goals for China: to be on par with the world's leading countries in AI by 2020, for AI to be its primary driver of industrial growth by 2025, and to become the world's primary AI innovation center and occupy the commanding heights of AI technology by 2030. The Chinese government's 2018 to 2020 three-year action plan for promoting the development of a new generation of artificial intelligence industry seeks to make China the leader in integrating AI in the healthcare, robotics, manufacturing, and automobile and other sectors. The government recruited leading Chinese IT firms, including Alibaba, Baidu, and Tencent, to build national AI innovation platforms. For the first time ever, more venture capital funding went to Chinese startup AI companies in 2017 than to American ones. Doubling down on the national security implications of the AI revolution, The document called for the implementation of what it called a military-civilian integration development strategy to promote the formation of an all-element, multi-field, high-efficiency AI military-civilian integration pattern. In the United States, by the time the Chinese plan was issued, the Obama administration had been replaced by the Donald Trump administration. It took the new U.S. president a year and a half to appoint a science advisor to lead the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, OSTP, and even by then, a majority of the staff positions in the OSTP had not been filled. The president's proposed 2018 budget called for major cuts at the National Institutes of Health, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, the National Science Foundation, and other federal agencies involved with AI research and science more generally. Immigration visas, including for exceptionally talented specialists, were restricted. Among the few recognitions by the administration of the importance of AI was the creation of a White House Select Committee on Artificial Intelligence in May 2018, but little seemed to come from the effort. With the U.S. government less focused on supporting the technologies of the future, China is vying aggressively to assume leadership in unlocking the secrets of the genome and ushering in the new era of precision medicine to help realize the country's broader strategic aspirations. Evidence of China's commitment to winning this race in advanced genetics and personalized medicine is everywhere. China's recently announced plan to establish national leadership in precision medicine, for example, dwarfed the much smaller initiative pledged by the Obama administration, later undermined by President Trump. Although the U.S. company Illumina remains the leader in building advanced sequencing machines, China is quickly becoming the dominant power in bringing together the massive data sets that will drive the next phases of understanding how genes function. U.S. research capabilities remain the best in the world, but Chinese authors' publications in the world's leading medical journals have doubled in recent years, and the number of U.S. patents granted to Chinese inventors and companies is increasing at nearly 30% annually, far faster than their American counterparts. Chinese research and development spending has increased by an astounding average of 15% a year for most of the past two decades and is now second largest in the world. It is still less than the United States, but more than all the European Union countries combined. China also awards more science and engineering PhDs than any other country. With their massive scientific investment and industrial bases, the United States and China are increasingly competing in a two-horse race to be the leading economy and scientific powerhouse of the future. This competition will impact every advanced technology influenced and revolutionized by AI, genomics in many ways foremost among them. In the age of AI, a U.S.-China duopoly is not just inevitable. Kai-Fu Lee, founder of Beijing-based technology investment firm Sinovation Ventures and former Microsoft and Google executive, recently asserted, it has already arrived. As researchers Eleanor Powells and Pratima Vidyarthi write, increasingly, the U.S.-China relationship will not be defined by the ownership of 20th-century manufacturing industries, but by a race in genetic and computing innovation that will drive the economy of the future. Some of this competition will be win-win, where humanity at large benefits from a faster rate of progress realized through competition. Some of it will be zero-sum, where some societies, companies, and individuals will lose power, market share, and perhaps even autonomy as others gain them. Because the wealth and power that will accrue to those countries, companies, and people who lead these revolutions is immense and unpredictable, the race is on. The companies and countries that crack the code of diseases like cancer and thousands of others and gain the ability to understand and potentially alter other human traits will be not just the biology versions of Google and Alibaba, but have the potential to be more equivalent in their power and influence to the 13th century Mongols, the 19th century British, or the 20th century Americans. As these two great ecosystems of innovation compete, each will have a unique set of strengths and weaknesses that will together determine how this rivalry plays out and impacts the application of genetic technologies. China, for example, will have larger genetic data sets because its population is larger, it is collecting genetic samples much more aggressively, and because data privacy regulations are far weaker than in the United States or Europe. America and Europe's higher levels of privacy protection for personal data could help maintain public support for genetics research and applications, or could become an Achilles heel if it keeps American and European researchers from accessing genetic datasets as robust as that of their Chinese counterparts. As this rivalry plays out, new national champion companies will emerge, the life sciences equivalents of the American FAMG technology behemoths, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, and Chinese bats, Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent. Already, American companies like IBM and new Chinese companies like iCarbonX are positioning themselves to assume this mantle. Founded by former BGI CEO Wang Jin in October 2015, iCarbonX seeks to build an ecosystem of digital life based on a combination of an individual's biological, behavioral, and psychological data, the internet, and artificial intelligence. By combining comprehensive biological, patient-generated data with AI technology, it plans to help consumers better understand the medical, behavioral, and environmental factors in their lives to optimize their health, and to help companies use genetic data to optimize their products and services. Wang Jin's plan is to ultimately build a predictive digital avatar of hundreds of millions of customers, allowing them to pass from sequencing to fully digitizing themselves. "We can digitalize everyone's life information," Wang Jin says, "interpret the data, find more valuable law of life, and thus enhance the quality of people's lives." With Tencent and the private equity behemoth Sequoia Capital as early investors, by 2017, iCarbonX quickly shot up to a $1 billion valuation, becoming China's first biotechnology unicorn. This convergence of competitive pressures on the individual, business, and societal levels will push the boundaries of how genetic tools are utilized and confer an increasingly broad set of advantages on the people, companies, and countries who optimize their development and application. But while all of these competitive pressures drive the adoption of genetic technologies forward, the same types of competitive pressures also have the significant potential to drive conflict within and between communities and states. Imagine you are the leader of a society that has chosen to opt out of the genetic arms race by banning embryo selection and genetic alteration. Because your country is progressive enough to make a collective decision like this, parents desiring these services are free to go elsewhere to get what they want. But preventing the genetic alteration of your population by definition requires both restricting genetic enhancement at home and enhanced people or expectant mothers carrying genetically altered embryos from entering your country. To protect the genetic integrity of your populations and keep genetically enhanced people out, you would need to perform genetic tests on all people entering the country. But there would likely be no way of knowing whether a person had been genetically enhanced without knowledge of their genetic baseline, their genome prior to any changes. For those few people for whom genetic information from the moment a few days after their conception is available, their former and current genetics could be compared. Everyone not able to provide baseline genetic information might be banned from entering the country or threatened with long jail terms for procreating with a citizen of it. to prevent women from going abroad to have genetically engineered embryos implanted, pregnancy tests would need to be performed on all women of fertile age coming into your country. Prenatal blood tests would then need to be performed on the pregnant women to try to guess if the embryos had been manipulated in some way. Even with a list of the most fashionable genetic alterations, this would be all but impossible. To be effective, these types of blood and prenatal tests would probably need to be accompanied by a polygraph asking pregnant women if they are carrying a genetically enhanced embryo. If someone already in the country was identified as enhanced, what penalties could possibly be meted out? Even if enhanced people were stripped of their citizenship and exiled for giving birth to a genetically enhanced person, their children would also need to be imprisoned, banned from procreating, or exiled. Enforcing any of this would require building the oversight machinery of the most totalitarian, intrusive, abusive, and downright odious police state, with the ability to track people's movements and continually monitor their biology and that of their children. But let's say your country has done all this and become a preserve of non-genetically enhanced people. We've already heard why different states will adopt advanced genetic engineering technologies at different rates based on the significant historical, cultural, and structural differences between them. Imagine you are assessing your country's options in a world where your country has opted out, but other countries are moving forward with human genetic enhancement. Here are your general choices. Option 1. You recognize that your country has made a moral decision based on your collective values and accept facing the consequences, even if this means your country will gradually lose its competitive advantage and future generations will be less healthy, live shorter lives, and have fewer superstars of various sorts. You sit tight in your belief you've made the right choice. With Schadenfreude in your heart, you hope your national decision will give you a competitive advantage if and when human genetic enhancement proves to be less beneficial and more dangerous than initially believed. Because your country has taken such a strong and principled stand on human genetic engineering, you feel duty-bound to protect this ban against encroachment. You are a progressive in your heart, but recognize you'll need some trappings of a police state to maintain your country's genetic purity. How is it, you ask yourself late at night, that an idealist like you is starting to adopt the language of Nazism? Option 2. You try to hold the line and support your national decision, but feel the pressure growing. Many of your most talented people are leaving the country to get the genetic enhancement services they want. Your unenhanced aspiring Olympic athletes and advanced coders are becoming community organizers, yogis, and nurses instead, pursuing careers that don't require competition with their enhanced counterparts. Parents are having second thoughts about your ban as they hear about kids in other countries who are immune to genetic diseases, doing better on IQ tests, and achieving all sorts of seemingly superhuman feats. Your military is worried your future soldiers will be at a disadvantage compared to their genetically enhanced adversaries. The leaders of your national space program tell you that your unenhanced astronauts will, unlike their enhanced counterparts from other countries, not be able to withstand the radiation exposure and bone density loss of extended space travel. Opting out is seeming less appealing an option. You need a face-saving alternative. You call for a national referendum. After a heated debate, you cast your vote to opt in. Option 3. You see the benefits of genetic enhancement, but your citizens still believe meddling with the human genome and rewriting biology is a form of hubris likely to end badly. As a matter of principle, you recognize that societies, like people, are diverse and don't begrudge the many other choices different societies make in all sorts of areas. But this is different. If other societies genetically enhance their populations and yours doesn't, you may not just be at a competitive disadvantage in the future. you may not be able to protect your population from the very thing they have so adamantly opposed. Just like genetically modified crops spread into adjacent fields and gene-drived mosquitoes spread across national boundaries, there will be really no way to protect your population from inheriting what you see as unnatural genetic modifications unless other countries can be prevented from allowing the most egregious modifications. Your only option is not just for your country to opt out, but to define, promote, and seek to enforce limits on genetic enhancement for all countries to follow. You ask your top advisors how you can make this happen. First on their list is trying to use your national powers of persuasion to convince people and countries around the world that the downsides of human genetic enhancement outweigh the benefits. But what are the chances of your being able to convince the whole world to buy into your pessimism, particularly when other societies are enthusiastically racing forward into the genetics age? Second, you can try to build an alliance of like-minded states to collectively pressure other countries to limit genetic enhancement. Getting an enforceable global treaty to limit genetic enhancement is an appealing option, but it's difficult to do. Most global leaders agree that human-induced climate change is threatening the livability of our planet, but we've not been able to get an enforceable global treaty to turn things around. Could a global effort limiting a technology many people and other states support be more effective than the high-profile efforts to limit climate change? Third, you identify the enhancing countries you are most concerned about and, if you have the power and influence to do it, try to stop them to set an example. One Central Asian country in particular has become a hub for highly aggressive genetic alterations of pre-implanted embryos designed to create superhuman capabilities. Parents are sending their frozen eggs and sperm, or skin grafts and blood samples from which these sex cells are being generated, to this country for embryo selection, embryo mating, and genetic enhancement. For the Central Asian country, building this industry is seen as a moral imperative, a great business opportunity, and a strategic boon. You ask them nicely to stop. They refuse. Perhaps you try getting a group of countries to impose travel, economic, or other sanctions on the offending country. If none of these approaches work, are you willing to use military force to stop the genetic alteration of the human species? It's certainly one option on the list. Over the course of the 20th century, an estimated 170 countries were invaded by others for a whole host of reasons, ranging from outright theft to ideological differences to preemption of a wide range of perceived threats. Is it so outlandish to believe that countries in the future might resort to military force to prevent other countries from altering the shared genetic code of humanity? Many countries have been invaded for far less. Military force would be an option if advanced genetic enhancement were only being carried out in a relatively weak country, or even in international waters or space. But what happens if a powerful country like China takes the lead in deploying advanced genetic and other technology to enhance the capabilities of its populations, while another country, say the United States, has entirely opted out for political and other reasons? Would the United States and China be willing to use as much force over the potential transformation of our species as they are now threatening over a few contested reefs in the middle of the South China Sea? If all of these types of competitive pressures on the personal, communal, and national levels were rare in our human experience, an argument could be made that they could be avoided in the context of the genetics revolution. But because competition has been at the very core of our evolutionary process for almost 4 billion years, the overwhelming odds are that these same drivers will push us, unevenly but collectively, into our brave new world of increasingly sophisticated human genetic engineering. Both the competitive pressures pushing human genetic engineering forward and the potential conflict scenarios this competition is likely to spark are very real. If we do nothing to apply our best values to influence how the genetic revolution plays out, we will place ourselves on a path to conflict. Avoiding worst-case scenarios will require our species to come together as never before to figure out how the benefits of revolutionary genetic technologies might be optimized and the dangers minimized. The good news is that we've tried to do this kind of thing before. The bad news is that we've never fully succeeded.